So thus far in our study, we've talked about why it is that we need to be familiar with the evidence for the resurrection. And then we proceeded to talk about the kernel of the gospel. Four key facts. We know that Jesus died, and the corollary to that, that confirms his death, was that he was buried. We know that Jesus arose from the dead, and the corollary to that is that he was seen. He appeared. We have at least 12 specific instances of his appearances before others after returning from the grave. And this is the gospel story as it has been relayed to us. As we mentioned several classes ago, if you want to know that Jesus did come back from the dead, you don't discover that scientifically. You have to depend upon historical testimony, the legal historical method to know whether or not that did occur. But all that raises the question, did we hear the story correctly? And that's what we just examined in our most recent classes as we looked at the manuscript evidence. The manuscripts tell us that, yes, we did hear it correctly. It has been faithfully transferred down to us through the centuries, and I can know what these documents contained within them 2,000 years ago. Another question that we might ask is, did I hear it from credible sources? Did I hear it from boots on the ground, people that were there during the time of the events that they happened? And again, the manuscript evidence tells us that, yes, we did. We looked at both the external and internal evidence and drew some inferences there on how to date these books. So this leads us into a new question that we wish to entertain today. Can I trust what these books say? Is there a way to test them to find out if they're reliable? And that's where we turn our attention to the historical and archaeological accuracy of the New Testament. On the handout, and I'm out of copies this morning, I apologize. We're looking at page, first of all, we want to look at page 17. We want to start there. It is possible to believe something for which there is not a single shred of evidence to substantiate that belief. There are roughly 16 million Mormons or so, I think, and I want you to consider with me this quotation I have from a book by Lee Strobel, The Case for Christ. Lee Strobel was an atheist, and he is now a believer, and one of the things that swayed him from unbelief to belief was an examination, or I guess the thing that swayed him, was an examination of the evidence for the Gospels. And one of the things he did was talk about archaeology. And in his book, he made an interesting comparison. If you look, for example, on the top of page 17, archaeology's repeated affirmation of the New Testament's accuracy provides important corroboration for its reliability. This is in stark contrast with how archaeology has proved to be devastating for Mormonism. Although Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, claimed that his Book of Mormon is the most correct of any book upon the earth, a direct quote, archaeology has repeatedly failed to substantiate its claims about events that supposedly occurred long ago in the Americas. I remember writing to the Smithsonian Institute to inquire about whether there was any evidence supporting the claims of Mormonism, only to be told in unequivocal terms that its archaeologists see no direct connection between the archaeology of the New World and the subject matter of the book. As authors John Ankenberg and John Weldon concluded in a book on the topic, in other words, no Book of Mormon cities have ever been located. No Book of Mormon person, place, nation, or name has ever been found. No Book of Mormon artifacts, no Book of Mormon scriptures, no Book of Mormon inscriptions, nothing. Nothing which demonstrates the Book of Mormon is anything other than myth or invention has ever been found. Now, is that true of the books that contain the kernel of the gospel? Is that true of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Acts, 1 Corinthians? If you've been looking over some of the things we have on the lesson, you know that's not the case. Still on page 17, let's talk for a minute about Sir William Ramsay. I didn't give the dates of his life on the lesson, but he was born in 1851 and he died in 1939. Now there are two William Ramsays that are noted in history. This is Sir William Ramsay, Sir William Mitchell Ramsay. So if you get to looking up this guy and you want to know more about him, and you don't know if you got the right one. He was born 1851 and died 1939, and he was knighted Sir William Mitchell Ramsay. At the time that he lived, it was a popular theory that the book of Acts was written in the second century. So we dated the book of Acts to have been written no later than 63 A.D. At the time that he was living, people would have said it was written maybe 163 A.D. Now, if that's true, then this poses a challenge to the credibility of the Bible because, for example, in Luke chapter 1, the author of Acts, and if his sequel book is written in 63 A.D., his first book is written even earlier than that. In the first book, he says in Luke chapter 1 and verse 2, many other people have undertaken to compile an account of what's been accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses. Luke says, I didn't see it for myself, but I talked to people that did. And then when you get into the book of Acts, there are a few places where Luke starts to talk in terms of we. So at some points in Acts, he's no longer just a historian writing it all down after the fact. He's actually a participant in the events. So he claims to be there for himself for some of the things that he mentions in Acts. So if what William Ramsay had believed was true, all that credibility is just thrown out the window. And whoever said in Luke chapter 1 and verse 2 that he spoke to eyewitnesses was lying through his teeth. So then, let's read about Mr. William Ramsay. This is taken from the Wikipedia article about him. He was known for his careful attention to New Testament events, particularly the book of Acts and the Pauline epistles. What does that phrase Pauline epistles refer to? Anybody know? Yeah, all the letters written by Paul. That's right. When he first went to Asia Minor, many of the cities mentioned in Acts had no known location, and almost nothing was known of their detailed history or politics. The Acts of the Apostles was the only record, and Ramsay, skeptical, fully expected his own research to prove the author of Acts hopelessly inaccurate. Since no man could possibly know the details of Asia Minor more than 100 years after the event, this is when Acts was then supposed to have been written. He therefore set out to put the writer of Acts on trial. He devoted his life to unearthing the ancient cities and documents of Asia Minor. What that means is he went there himself. He traveled to the Mediterranean. This is an Englishman, obviously, if he's been knighted. And he goes through the very places that he reads of in Acts. After a lifetime of study, however, he concluded, further study showed that the book could bear the most minute scrutiny as an authority for the facts of the Aegean world, and that it was written with such judgment, skill, art, and perception of truth as to be a model of historical statement. On page 89 of the same book, Ramsay accounted, I set out to look for truth on the borderland where Greece and Asia meet, and found it there in Acts. You may press the words of Luke in a degree beyond any other historians, and they stand the keenest scrutiny and the hardest treatment. Joseph Smith said, I've written the most accurate book in the entire history of the world. Nothing has been found to corroborate it. Luke says, I talked to people who were there, and I was there myself for some of the events that I record. Here comes a noted archaeologist who is renowned in his field. He says, none of that could possibly be true. Starts out as a skeptic. Mr. Ramsay wound up becoming a believer simply because all he studied was whether or not Luke was true according to what we know from history and archaeology. So then, let's see what it was that convinced him. Let's look in Luke. Actually, we'll come back to the Gospel of Luke. I put that one on there, but we might do it last. Let's go, for example, to Acts chapter 12. And now we're looking at page 16. Acts chapter 12 and verse 23 is where we want to turn. On this lesson, I've listed three passages that Steve likes to drill in to his class when he teaches on Acts. But I know for most of us, when we think about dates in history, we'd probably prefer to have a frontal lobotomy than to commit dates to memory. We may think, what is the point of all this? Do I have to know this stuff to go to heaven? Do I have to know where all this fits on a secular time scale? Don't be afraid to tell me what you think. No, I don't. But could it possibly be that if I know some of this stuff that I might help myself get to heaven? Yeah. And could it be that if I know this stuff, I might be able to help somebody else get to heaven? Not that you have to be able to recite these backwards in your sleep, but if you at least have a working knowledge of them, this is so very helpful, because what it does is it pulls this story from the obscurity of myth where everybody wants to consign it. And it drags people that deny that this actually happened kicking and screaming into real events. Because not only does the Bible tell us of the world of the first century and the people that were important to it, but secular historians tell us the same thing. And as one book on archaeology described it, borrowing a phrase from Jesus, the stones cry out. They cry out saying that this really happened. These people did live. And the man that writes about it was right every single time. In Acts chapter 12 and verse 23, you read of the death of Herod. This is Herod Agrippa. And you see that an angel of the Lord struck him because he did not give God the glory. He was eaten by worms and he died. This same Herod's death is confirmed by Josephus. Who can tell me who Josephus was?
Jewish historian.
Roughly when did he live?
During the destruction.
Latter part of the first century, right? So he records some very major events that are pertinent to the study of the Bible and placing these events in their proper chronological sequence. He writes of the death of Herod, and based on the information that we have from him, we can date this to about 44 AD. And this is one of the key dates that you need to know in the book of Acts in order to establish a timeline as you go through the book. And the reason that's so helpful is for the reasons we talked about on Wednesday night, dating the books that contain the kernel of the gospel, one of them being 1 Corinthians, that catalog of appearances that Paul mentions in chapter 15. If you know when the events in Acts take place, you can conclude when that book was written. And it was not written hundreds of years after the fact. It was written about 57 AD, within the lifetime of many of the people that witnessed these very events that we have here. Look at Acts chapter 17. There are things that we take for granted in our Bible as being true that for a long time were disputed. When you get to Acts 17 and verse 1, as you read about Paul's second preaching journey, they traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, and they came to the city of Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. In the next few verses, you see Paul fulfilling his custom. He goes into the synagogue and he starts to reason with them from the law of Moses that Jesus of Nazareth was the Christ that had been foretold to them. In verse 5, the Jews becoming jealous, taking along some wicked men from the marketplace, they formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. And attacking the house of Jason, they were seeking to bring them out to the people. And when they did not find them, they began dragging Jason and some brethren before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also." At one time, Acts 17 and verse 6 was one of the most controversial passages in the New Testament. And we read that, we think, what's the big deal? And it all has to do with that phrase, the way this Bible puts it, city authorities. Your version may not say that. Do we have a New King James translation? Does it say anything different? Levi?
Dragging Jason is part of the rulers of the city. Some brethren to the rulers of the city.
Rulers of the city. Now, rulers of the city, city authorities, we think, what's the big deal? There's nothing in that that sounds controversial to us. In fact, it sounds pretty bland and generic. All we know that somebody is in charge, but we don't know much more about it than that. Well, the phrase interprets a word in Greek that's called a politarch, P-O-L-I-T-A-R-C-H. Now, people like Mr. Ramsey were told, and other people that studied archaeology, We're told that there was no such thing as a Polytarch. Luke got this hopelessly, completely wrong. This is a gross embarrassment on his part. Here he is claiming to be somebody that shows up on these journeys from time to time, and he doesn't know the first thing about the ancient world. Invents offices out of nothing. That's what was said for a long time. But what we find out is, through the study of archaeology, we actually have 19 separate inscriptions that mention a Polytarch. Five of them, go back to verse 1, five of those inscriptions refer to Thessalonica. This is the very place where Luke records the existence of this office. They were city officials that served both, executive and judicial functions. Interesting office that they had. If you ever go to London and you go to the British Museum, you'll find an inscription that bears a reference to this very office on display there. We look at things like this and we think, this is not the kind of stuff that grabs my eye when I read the book of Acts. I'm more interested, say, in what happens to these brethren after the Jews whip up this mob. I want to know what happens to Jason. I want to know what happens to Paul when he gets run out of town. I want to know more about how he talks to the Jews. Am I so much interested in, say, for example, Acts 17 and verse 2, when Luke says he goes into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures? And when I read Acts, do I really sit up and pay all that much attention to the passage of time every time I read it, or who's in charge here or who's in charge there? I think for a lot of us, the honest answer is no, we don't. Because we just take it for granted that it's true. And not only that, but we perhaps look for other things that we think shed greater spiritual light. But I know this, even if I'm not necessarily immediately excited by all the references to city officials and whatnot, it was important to Luke. And for that reason, I need to at least give some consideration to the passage of time and to who's in charge where and what's going on in the regions and so forth. And if you want to know, this is where the battles over whether or not this book is trustworthy are being fought. They might say, skeptics, there was no Jesus, and if there was, he didn't come back from the dead. But ultimately, they can't prove that. And what they try to do is make their stand on ground that they consider their own, on the grounds of archaeology. But time and again, the ground just gives out beneath their feet. Look in Acts chapter 18. Yes.
This goes to show us how far these people want to disprove the Bible. They're going to go. I mean, to find anything, whatever they can find, they can bring up and say, oh, look here. This is wrong. This is bad. This is not right. Isn't it?
You're right. Amazing. You're right. We'll grab any details. Rocky?
It's amazing. If you look at the four gospel readers, Luke, in a position in the Greek, as we know, he's the most accurate of all the four gospel writers. Shows you the Holy Spirit. You just think of a man that needs a lot of detail to record the Acts.
Right, right. The thing I like to say when I'm talking about Luke and his accuracy, he has a physician's attention to detail, and that shows up in all of his writings. It shows up in his documentation of who's in charge, the politics, the people, what the debates of the age were, what's going on. That really shines through in Acts 18 and verse 12. Again, this is one of those things that maybe when you're reading the Bible and you see this in your daily Bible reading or whatever, you don't pay much attention to it. But this is another key passage in Luke's writing that was disputed. You read of Gallio being the proconsul of Achaia. Now, Keith, what was Achaia for those of us that don't know? Okay, it was a region in that section of the world in which the city of Corinth was found. And Gallio is a proconsul, similar to the position of a governor. Not the exact same as a governor like Pilate would be. There was a bit more freedom and no standing army where Gallio was. But think about this with me. For the longest time, this was one of those things, again, that was disputed. And then a single inscription was found at Delphi. in the Grecian world that confirms Gallio and his proconsulship. And from the data that we have, we can date Gallio's reign from 51 to 52 AD. Now, on the lesson itself, I mentioned that proconsuls were only in power for 2 years. At least that was my understanding. High turnover in this job. But Gallio, as far as I can tell, he was only in power for 1 year. Now, why is that significant? Let's think about this from the standpoint of someone that says Luke wrote 100 years after the fact. And let's just do a little thought experiment. Levi, can you tell me who the president is?
Right now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Who is he? Humor me. Okay. John, can you tell me who the president was in 1917?
You
were
a boy.
Don't ask for help.
You're way off.
Wilson.
Wilson. That was a little bit too easy for some of y'all. Yeah. You weren't looking on your iPad, were you, Ronnie? Okay. Let's see. Who was Craig? You.
Which Craig?
Yeah. Can you tell me? Put your iPad up. Did you tell me who the president was in 1817?
Grant.
That's okay if you can't.
I said no.
Okay. Let's go back to the 1917 example. A lot of you guessed that it was Wilson. Who was the Chief Justice in 1917? That's a little bit harder. Who was the governor of Texas in 1917? Let's just jump the pond. Let's pick somebody that we would think, I never need to know that. Who was the Prime Minister of Great Britain in 1917? Nobody knows. And right now you're all thinking, who cares? I'm not going to be a contestant on Jeopardy anytime soon. And if I did need to know it, what would I do?
Google.
Yeah. If any man lacks wisdom, let him ask of Google, right? And you would find out. Go back over just for a second to Luke, and this time I want to look in chapter 3. Now, after the benefit of having 2,000 years worth of historical and archaeological advancement at our feet, and having a much more accurate sense of when events took place and what was involved in them, you would think that most of us would have a much better handle on events, but the fact is we tend to not put too much emphasis on things that we don't think are important. And for better or worse, most of us are the victims of educational malpractice, and for that reason we tend to think that history is just a big pile of worthless anyway. In Luke chapter 3 and verse 1, Luke writes, well, whoever this was, because it was written 100 years after the fact, he says, in the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, when Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea, and Herod was tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip was tetrarch of the region of Iturea and Trachonitis, and Lysanias was tetrarch of Abilene, and the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. That's a lot of wild stabs in the dark to make if you don't have nearly as accurate a history database to appeal to as we do today, 100 years later. Actually, even a little bit longer than that, because by the time he's recording events here, this is about the time of the ministry of John the Baptist, so it'll be about 130 years later. Now, Luke's a Gentile, verse 2. What does he care who the high priest is? Why does he need to know that? Just leave that out for a minute. Just leave it out for a minute. I know what you're saying is. Just leave it out. You're talking about a lot of lucky guesses. And if you go back to Acts 18 and verse 12, if this is written 100 years after the fact, this is really lucky. When a guy is in office just for 1 year, if I asked you who was president in 1917, you've got maybe 4 to 8 years to pick from. You can get lucky somewhere in there. But 1 year? Really strains credulity. Because especially when you think about it, he doesn't have Google. He doesn't have Siri. Does it make sense to think that he wrote it up hundreds of years after the fact? Or does it make more sense to think that he was who he said he was? a guy on the scene talking to people who were there, and himself a participant in some of the events that he records. If you look in, this is our second date, by the way, of the three key dates in Acts, 51 to 52 A.D. The last one is in Acts 24.
Todd,
yes.
You leave that one, adding to the amazing fact that he recorded this like he did is the fact that he calls it proconsul. And you, I think you may reference the difference in the type of provinces that were there. Tiberius had made it, I believe, imperial province. Claudius changed it to a senatorial province. We got proconsul. But how did he know? I mean, this thing switched, and he used the right word, proconsul, instead of procurator. So that adds to the possibility of error if he was guessing.
Yes. Yeah. And an imperial province would, I'm assuming, be closer to what Pilate had.
Yeah, you had a standing army.
Yes.
The possibility of more problems. So procurator, but one that was known to be peaceful and all that. It's a different kind of province, different kind of rulership. So how would Luke know that if you'd like to say right 100 years later?
Right. Right.
And it just increases the potential for error.
No doubt. And this is true in the potential for error would be true in every single person that he mentions, which is astounding when you consider, as one man put it, Luke names 32 countries. And you think about how many countries no longer exist even since I was a little boy. Soviet Union is gone. Eastern Europe is different now than what it was. The Middle East is different now. Luke mentions 32 countries, 54 cities, 9 islands, without a single error. In Acts 24, he mentions Felix, who succeeded Porcius Festus. A little bit more guesswork is involved in this, but his procuratorship began roughly 59 to 60 A.D., again confirmed by Josephus. Now, does Josephus have any sort of bias in making sure that Luke is received as a credible historian? What kind of...
It'd be just the opposite.
Right. Yeah, he's Jewish, right? He doesn't care to back up the story of Christianity. Sir?
He was a Pharisee.
Pharisee? I did not know that. Okay. So that would heighten the animosity even more so if he's a member of that division of the Jews. Go back over to Luke chapter 3 for a second, the text that we read a moment ago. Steve mentioned the accuracy in naming not just Gallio, but that he was a proconsul. I guess even the existence of Pilate has been disputed by some. In Luke chapter 3 and verse 1, the text that we read a moment ago, Tiberius Caesar, you'd have to be an idiot to deny that he existed or that he reigned when he did. He also mentions Pontius Pilate was governor of Judea. And an inscription has been found that mentions Pilate, who was prefect, and the word that's translated governor in our Bibles today captures that idea. It's a different sort of office than what Gallio had, prefect of Judea. That's mentioned exactly. So yes, the stones cry out once more and confirm Luke's amazing accuracy over and over. Now flip back a little bit to chapter 2. This is one of the rare instances in Luke's gospel where nothing has been found yet, so far as we know, from the stones or from the ancient records of this day and age that confirm that this happened. But just because something has not been found yet that confirms it happened when it happened doesn't mean that it didn't happen. And I want you to pay attention to that, because the argument that people make is, well, essentially, what we know just contradicts what Luke recorded here. But that's not true. There's a difference in finding something that blatantly conflicts with what the Bible tells you, and on the other hand, not finding anything that happens to back it up. There's a huge difference in those two things. Luke is talking about the birth of Jesus in chapter 2 and verse 1. He says, "In those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken of all the inhabited earth." Now, I guess that last phrase is one of those that people would get hung up on. But obviously Caesar is not conducting a census of Australia and Japan. Whole inhabited earth is the whole for a part of the earth that he rules over. This is just the Roman Empire and all of its provinces. In verse 2, the time frame is given to us. The first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone was on his way to register for the census, each to his own city. As you read through the rest of the account, in verse 4, you read that Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family of David. Galilee, where he's from, is quite a distance away from Nazareth. This is another one of those things that people disputed. People just wouldn't travel that far to register for this census and pay the taxes that came with it. Well, archaeology tells us that, yes, they would. They would return to their ancestral home for an event like this, just as Luke tells us. Now, the real stickler, though, is found in verse 2. A census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. It's interesting to me that this is one of the few places that is disputed. If this is one of the few places that's disputed, what does that tell you about the rest of what he wrote?
Undisputable.
Yeah, it's undisputable. So you just can't throw the rest of that out at the window just because this one is disputed. As I said on the lesson, no outside archaeological evidence has been unearthed to confirm what Luke wrote about the census. We read of another census that was taken in AD 6. By Quirinius, who was governor of Syria. This census in Luke chapter 2 and verse 2 would have been taking place around 4 BC. And if you're wondering how was Jesus born 4 years before Christ, that's a long story that has to deal with an error in the original dating, but that's now usually the accepted year of his birth. So this would be a variance of about 10 years. Look, hold your place here and look over in Acts chapter 5 for a second. Acts 5 and verse 37. Some people say that Luke just got confused and he's talking about a census that occurred after Jesus' birth instead of one that took place shortly before it. Well, that doesn't make any sense because Luke is painstakingly meticulous. And when you read his second book, Acts, you realize that he actually knew about that other census. In Acts 5 and verse 37, he quotes Gamaliel, who mentions, "After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census and drew away some people after him. He too perished." This was a tax revolt that took place in AD 6. He knew about that other census. It's unlikely to me that he would get them confused. So then, we're back to what we have in Luke chapter 2 and verse 2. People say this is a contradiction. That is only true if the two censuses both cannot have happened. And there's nothing, so far as I'm aware, that requires that they both could not have taken place. And what some people have suggested is we know from an inscription that was found in Antioch about Quirinius being governor. Some suggest that he was governor of Syria around 7 BC and would have begun the census that was still ongoing around 4 BC. And then he became governor of Syria once more around 6 AD. And that would certainly harmonize both of the censuses as we have them in the gospel account and in secular history. But as I said, the real difficulty people have with this is that nothing has been found yet that says, yes, there was a census around the time of the birth of Jesus by the same man. But so what? What people are looking for is secular evidence, and what they refuse to consider is that a doctor who lived in the first century, who's painstakingly detailed and incredibly accurate 99.9% of the time, that counts as your evidence. And that is the testimony that it occurred and when it occurred. And they want to discount it because he talks about a woman that had never known a man having a baby and in that same man growing up and dying and then coming back from the dead. Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, and in my mind, this is not as significant a difficulty as people make it out to be. I wanted to mention it, though, because this is the best that people can do. And if this is the best that they can do, then it's really not that much that they can throw against Luke and his accuracy time and again. Okay, we've got just a few minutes left. I'm only going to make reference to the geographical accuracy. I'm only pulling from passages in the gospel accounts or in Acts because, again, those are the documents that contain the kernel of the gospel, the resurrection of Jesus. Location of Jericho, this is another one of those that people have made a big fuss over. Was Jesus leaving the city or was he going into it? Was he going up to it? Was he going down to it? There's a lot about the geography of that area that could show that it may have been both. And you can read about that on the bottom of page 16. There's other places that have been unearthed, such as the Pool of Bethesda and its five porticos in John 5. And again, you see that the New Testament is right. And that's just the New Testament. We're not even talking about the archaeological evidence for the Old Testament, which in and of itself is considerable. Okay, any thoughts or comments on anything we have discussed thus far? I'll mention a few other examples, perhaps, from Luke's writing here in a second.
Todd,
yeah.
On the census, in Acts 5:37, are you saying that was the second census?
That was the second census in 6 A.D.
So it's kind of amazing that in Luke 2, all the detail that is around what he's talking about, you notice that it's the first sentence. They indicate there's another sentence. So even though you can't date the point the first sentence, there's some indication that it's the second sentence.
Okay, so that's interesting, the way that he writes it in...
First, and if it was a second, yeah. Well, that's a second, so it kind of implies there's a...
Okay, good comment. So Luke mentions a first census taking place in Luke 2 and verse 2. That may imply a second one that he could refer to in Acts chapter 5. If you look in Acts chapter 19... I mentioned on Wednesday, I think, when I was previewing what we would talk about in this lesson, that I shortchanged Luke quite a bit. There's so many more examples you could get into over and over that confirm how accurate he was. In Acts chapter 19, you read about Paul in the city of Ephesus, and there's a great turning away from paganism to Christianity. People that once practiced pagan religions in verse 19, they take their old pagan books and they burn them, and Luke calculates the worth of the books at 50,000 pieces of silver. In verse 24, you read about Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis. She's the goddess of this town. He starts to whip up a mob and says essentially in verse 25, if we don't stop this Christianity thing, we'll be out of business. And then there's this great uproar, and you read of this mob being formed, and people go to an assembly. In Acts 19 and verse 32, they go into this theater. Some were shouting one thing and some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and the majority did not know for what reason they had come together. And further down in verse 39, there is a town clerk that talks some sense into these people and quiets them down. If you want anything beyond this, it shall be settled in the lawful assembly. The word for assembly there is ecclesia, from which we get our word church. And what they have found is an inscription on the theater in Ephesus that has been excavated. And the inscription references that silver statues of Artemis would be placed in the theater during a full session of the ecclesia, the body politic or the town council, as it were. This theater would hold 25,000 people. Back up in the text... let's see. One of Paul's traveling companions really gets everybody riled up in verse 34, simply because they recognized that he was a Jew. And there was a sign outside of this theater that said, if you were a foreigner, basically, we're not responsible if you die, if you go into it. So they were very much... antagonistic toward outsiders coming into their assembly. So time and time again, this book is right over and over. And if he's right, and other holy books are not, it starts to make you wonder As I say on page 18, if he's so painstakingly accurate in his historical reporting, on what basis can we assume he was credulous or inaccurate when it came to reporting about a virgin birth or a resurrection of the dead? And what would be true of Luke would also be true of Matthew, Mark, John, and Paul. All right, we're just about out of time. I want to mention that I don't have the next lesson out. I'm hoping to have that one out tonight for you to pick up. And what we want to do on Wednesday is talk about the authors and assess whether or not they were credulous, uninformed people. And we want to look at Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and Paul and see what we can learn about them as being credible with their testimony being credible for the events that they record. Thank you.